On Tuesday nights, each week, I have a class that I teach for young adults. Now, I have to say double young, because pretty much a lot of times young adults, just one young adult, is defined as 18 to 39. Evidently, when you cross into the 40s, you're already on the downhill slope. But a young adults is what I defined as 18 to 25. And so, by the way, if any of you are here, 18 to 25, we spend I spend Tuesday nights from 7:30 to 8:45. We should talk about theology, and we talk, answer questions. It's a good place to meet, especially other young adults, Catholics who, when these people come to the class, you know that they're trying to be not just cultural Catholics, but they're trying to be intentional disciples. And always remember that an intentional disciple, a disciple is a student. And if you're a student, you should go to class, or you should at least study on something. So anyway, but at that class, one of the questions that was asked, and everybody wanted to go around and answer it, was, what do you most admire about Jesus? What do you most admire about Jesus? And we were going around. There was about 20 people there. We were going around answering. And, of course, different people were saying different things. But when it came to me, I had to really struggle. Because I admire a lot of things about Jesus. I couldn't pick one. But something inside of me, I got in touch with the thing that I admire most about Jesus. And the thing that I admire most about him is his laser-like dedication to his mission. And so what I'd like to do today is to expand that a little, because the whole notion of living for your mission is something that I think every Catholic Christian, every Christian, should really be trying to do in their lives. So let me break it down, and especially on this feast of the baptism of Jesus. I want you to notice the life of Jesus prior to his baptism and post his baptism. What we know of Jesus, of course, is his birth, but he doesn't do anything on that one. He just receives it's the incarnation. But the first time we see Jesus making decisions is when he stays consciously behind at the temple when his mom and dad went to celebrate the Holy Day. And then each of them thinks that they're with the other, and they come to find out 2 or 3 days later that they can't find him. And so they go back to Jerusalem. Now, the first thing we see is that Jesus, he gives a very weird answer. Mary says, "How could you do this to us? We were worried sick about you." That's a paraphrase. "We were worried sick about you." And of course, Jesus says, "Why?" Now, that's one of the duh moments of the New Testament. Why? If your 12-year-old son is lost for 3 days, I think anybody would be worried. But Jesus says, "Did you not know that I had to be in my Father's house?" Now, him being 12, and with that moment in time, that was not the start of his mission, although it begins to prefigure it You begin to see his overriding concern that he thinks everybody should have. Because, I mean, when he says to his mom and dad, "Why were you concerned about me?" he's basically saying, "Didn't you know that I had to be about my mission?" He didn't say in those words, but that's exactly what was coming across. And so we see already the prefiguring of that. But then the New Testament says that he went back to Nazareth, and kind of almost quoting it, he said, the New Testament says, where he was subject to them and grew in wisdom, age, and grace. Now notice, from that age until the age of 30, we don't hear a thing about Jesus. And then, at the age of 30, and we don't exactly know why 30, but at the age of 30, he goes to his cousin, and he is baptized in the River Jordan. From that moment on, his life is radically different. Now, please understand, the baptism of John was not the same baptism that you and I get. Jesus was not baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. But it was a definite moment of transformation of Jesus. And from then on, you see his public ministry. Now, I've begun to make a distinction that I think is a distinction that's important for us. You know, we use the word disciple and apostle. Sometimes the same. The 12 disciples, the 12 apostles. But they really are not the same. And I think it is appropriate to apply the two different words to the two different phases of Jesus. You see, for the first 30 years of his life, Jesus was growing, as the Bible says, growing in wisdom, age, and grace. That was his discipleship stage. His father, in some way or another, we don't know because the Bible doesn't speak about it, but his father was taking that time to prepare him for the second half of his life, or the second phase of his life, his apostleship. And we never think about Jesus as an apostle, but the word applies to him just as much as to the other 12. And why? Because the word, of course, the word apostle comes from the, you guys know that I'm addicted to etymologies, but the word apostle comes from two Greek parts. Apo, and apo means away. Away. And so, for example, when you apologize, logize means reason, logos, and apo means away. So when you apologize, what are you doing? You are giving reasons to turn away or to excuse yourself from a guilt. That's what apologize means. When you study apologetics, you are studying the field of theology that helps you to give explanations to people who question you about your faith in order to turn away objections. Okay? And so the word apo is away, and the second part of the word is stelein. And stelein means sent. And so a apostolein, or apostle in English, is one who is sent. Now, a disciple is, of course, I didn't do the etymology on that, but it's not hard to hear the word discipline, a person who is learning, a person who is studying. So you can see the two phases, the phase of discipleship and apostleship. And ship, when you use it there, is the art or practice of anything, like penmanship, authorship, anything like that. Now, apply those two words to Jesus' life. For the first years, majority of his life, he was preparing. Now, who was he a disciple of? He was listening to his Father. You don't grow in wisdom, age, and grace without having a relationship with God, who is the source of wisdom and grace. You don't do that. And so for the first 30 years of his life, I imagine at 12 years old, he already had a small component of apostleship, because you heard it in his explanation to his parents about that he had to be in his mission. But the majority of his life was discipleship, learning from his Father, and little of apostleship. But now look at what happens in his baptism. At some point, Jesus began to be extremely aware that it was time. Now, how did he come to that awareness that it was time? We don't know. We don't know. But we do know that he went to John. And John was the one who announced him. Now, you notice how John is already being seen as, is this going to be the Messiah? And people were confused. And that's why John said, no, I am not. One is coming after me. I'm just baptizing you with water. And he's differentiating the water baptism from the baptism of Jesus. And so when Jesus finishes his disciple stage, and he's still, you never finish 100% the disciple stage. What's happening is the disciple stage is dominant at the first part of his life, and the apostle phase is much smaller. Now it's going to invert. And Jesus is now being sent away, apostolane, by the Father. And when he starts, I want you to notice the extreme focus of his life on his mission. Constantly the focus. Starting, if you remember, with Satan in the desert. Remember when the devil tempts him? And the devil says, he shows them all of the kingdoms of the world, including West Chase. And he shows them all of these kingdoms of the world. And the devil says, you see all of this, past, present, and future? They're all mine. And I can give them to you if you find me of greatest worth. He said, if you worship me, which is to find me of greatest worth. And at that moment, Jesus is being tempted to take the easy road so that he doesn't have to do his mission the way he ought to be doing it. And so he rejects Satan. And then he goes out and he starts preaching and he starts doing miracles. Now please understand, Jesus' miracles were not sort of at random. Okay? The miracles of Jesus were to show people that he had authority over nature. And that if a person has authority over nature, it sort of corroborates the fact that if they're making other claims that sound absurd, that it emphasizes the validity of those claims. I was teaching the young adults, and we had a funny moment because I was trying to get them to understand the amazing impact Jesus must have had. And I asked him, I want you to imagine that you're my disciples. And we go down here to the cemetery at Derry Ashford. Is that what? It's Forest Park? Yeah, I think it's Forest Park. What if you went with me to Forest Park and I stood before a grave and I looked at the grave and I said, who in there, get up and come and live. Now, I can do that. I know I can. Now, I can guarantee you nothing will happen. Okay? Nothing will happen. Okay? But what if all of a sudden this dude would get up out of his casket and somehow break through the ground and come out? How would you react? And it was funny. Two of the kids in the group said, I'd run like H-E-L-L. I said, why would you run like H-E-L-L? And he said, because that's scary stuff. That is scary stuff. Now, when somebody does that in front of you, and he keeps doing that, you know, imagine a person, you're in a boat with them, and there's a huge storm, and they wake you, you're taking a nap, and you're woken up, and the person stands up and looks at the storm and says, oh, stop it. And the storm goes, I don't know that I'd run. I might jump into the sea, get away from that guy, because something is. But notice what's happening. Jesus has this focus on his mission, and he keeps going and going. People want him to do all kinds of healings, but he doesn't stay in one place. He doesn't allow. Remember when he multiplied the fish and the loaves? They wanted to make him king. They wanted to make him king. Free food. Okay? This guy has to be our king. Free food. Okay? They wanted to make him king. And what does he do? Notice he does not attempt at all to build a following. He doesn't attempt to say, oh man, I'm getting really popular. My church is full on Sundays. It's not. Doesn't attempt to do that. He slips away, runs away. And the reason for that is that he is constantly focused on the mission that the Father has given him to do. Now that mission, how he understood it, we don't know. But at some time during his life, he knew that the mission would conclude with what he called his hour. And his hour was the point in time where he would go straight to Jerusalem, and he knew that when he went there, he was setting up a confrontation between the power of evil and the power of God. He knew that he was setting up that confrontation. That's why he got so angry with Peter. Because Peter, when they're up in the mountain, Peter says, up for the transfiguration, Peter doesn't want anything bad to happen to Jesus. And of course, he says, oh, Lord, may that not happen to you. And all of a sudden, you know, that's a very nice thing. Very nice thing. If I tell people I'm going to Target and I'm going to be kidnapped, tortured, and killed, most of you, I think, would say, oh, Father, don't do that. Okay? Because Jesus should have said thank you. He should have said thank you for thinking of me. What does he say? Get behind me, you Satan. Boy, you talk about getting kicked in the teeth. And why? Because without knowing it, Peter was echoing what Satan had done in the desert, without knowing it. And then Jesus goes laser-like straight into what he knows is the end of his mission. What he knows is about to trigger his death, and he knows it. And I won't go too far into this, but it always amazes me when he asked the apostles, I mean, this time the disciples to get the meal ready for Passover. And then he tells Judas, go do what you're supposed to do. He's almost directing it. Go do what you're supposed to do. And then how did Judas, have you ever asked yourself this? How did Judas know where he was going to be to bring the people, the soldiers? Because that's where they always went. And so what does Jesus do? He goes where they always go. Why? So he can be found. So he can be found. He could have gone someplace else. And he sits there and waits. He is totally nervous, sweating blood, asking God, oh, please, please, if I don't have to go through this. He knows what's about to happen. And yet he stays. And of course, we all know what happens. Look at the focus on the mission. Jesus is not about enjoying life. I'm not saying enjoying life is bad. But enjoying life cannot be your mission. It may be a byproduct of your mission. And so, let me bring this plane in for a landing. What does that have to say about our lives? And I think there's a lot to be said about our lives. First of all of us are in hopefully moving from cultural Catholics to intentional discipleship. Meaning we are men and women who are doing our best to be educated, taught, to think like Jesus. The whole point of being a Catholic Christian is to change the way you think. Please understand, it's not about going to church. Going to church is it's a good thing and it helps. But it's about changing the way you think so that you think like Jesus. You hold the things that are important the way Jesus would hold them. That's what's called worship. What is worth it, you begin to put in different orders. It's the etymology of the word worth-ship. And so the very first thing in discipleship, intentional discipleship, is that you take Jesus as the model of who you ought to be. And a recognition that you and I are screwed up. And that if you don't have a model of who you ought to be, what you're basically doing is saying, I am satisfied being screwed up. And so a Christian begins, especially with kids and teens, begins at the time of discipleship. They may have little pieces of apostleship, but not yet. But there ought to be a moment in your life, and for most of us, it probably won't be our baptism. Because our baptism, we were baptized. I was baptized when I was a baby. And so most of you. But there has to be a time that you begin to grow into saying, well, you begin to answer the question, what's the purpose of my life? What's the mission that God has given to me? Because every single one of us has been given a mission. It may not be, don't think of it as I'm supposed to save the world or anything like that. It may be taking the little kid that God has given to you and raising him correctly and being a good father or a good mother. It may be helping people in some way or another. Something has been given to you that is not about you. That's how you can tell what a mission is. Something has been given to you to accomplish that is not about you being happy. Now, you may be happy doing it, but that's not the goal of it. That's what, you know, what I loved about, remember a long time ago we did something called The Purpose-Driven Life? And the first line of that book, The Purpose-Driven, if you haven't read it, read it. The purpose of the first line of that book is, it's not about you. It's not about you. And that is, he's introducing us to the whole notion of the purpose and mission of your life. And so today, as we're celebrating the baptism of Jesus, Take a look, take a part of your time and do some serious reflecting. There should be an aspect of discipleship. There ought to be in every single life. You should be a lifelong learner on how to think and prioritize life the way Jesus did. That ought to be a lifelong thing for you. It's not about coming to church. It's about actively, intentionally studying how to be like Jesus. And then, as you get older, the component of that line should be more and more, what are you being sent away to do? What is the purpose of your life? What is the mission? That is the way we live. Let me close with this. I enjoy studying American government, and I enjoy studying the philosophy behind especially the founding documents. And the Declaration of Independence has always had a very special place for me. Because the Declaration of Independence says that all of us are endowed with inalienable rights, and among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I like the first two. The third one, not so much. You see, life is not about pursuing happiness. Now, none of us wants to be sad, but it's not about pursuing happiness. Life is about, and it says it, Paul says it. He says, Christian, you pursue righteousness. Pursue righteousness. Being focused on God. Pursue that. Because if you pursue happiness, you could make an argument to say, well, you know, I really enjoy cocaine. I'd like to spend my life high on cocaine. That is my happiness. Makes no sense. And so you pursue righteousness. And so when you start pursuing righteousness, a right relationship with God, slowly you're going to become aware of the purpose of your life and of the mission that you have been given. Discipleship, apostleship. It should be part of each one of our lives. God bless. Thanks for listening.